we're going to continue with 0803 and as quickly as we can do the last items, at least that I have on my agenda, and any items that anyone else has on their agenda. Justice Ziegler's has withdrawn from participation on this matter. No other justice will be allowed to do so. I know. Justice Crook said he's been thinking about it. We're going to keep following through. Okay. Here's what I've got as left. And first thing I want to do is about the use of the word demand account. It's my understanding that Keith Saleen thinks this is an important issue. Mr. Saleen?
Thank you, Chief Justice. It is an important issue, but I think there are some ways that we might be able to resolve the conflict we have. I haven't had the opportunity I would like to speak with Mr.
You'll
Knight
have
about
to speak
that.
Up, please.
Thank you. What happened when we went through the revisions earlier in working with the Bankers Association, which has been always a very fruitful discussion because we come from different perspectives and have some different regulatory schemes, is to find language that satisfies the needs of both the regulatory system and the banking industry and their clients. And when we went through this earlier, the word demand accounts was one that we had agreed on as something that could work for both of us at that time. Now there appear to be some issues there that I don't fully understand yet that I think Mr. Knight might be able to help me with once I get a chance to speak with him a little bit more. When we have pooled accounts, lawyer trust accounts that are pooled, it's important to have very good accountability of the funds. And this works best when you have a checking type account or a demand account. As we defined it in the trust account rule, an account from which funds are dispersed through a properly payable instrument. This is something then that would be prepared by the lawyer in many cases, as I understand it, and would be returned to the lawyer as part of the records. It enables the lawyer to fulfill his or her fiduciary responsibilities, and it enables our office to properly audit and determine the tracking of funds and what happened. And so those are the reasons why we would need something in there to accommodate our concern that we have that kind of record keeping and ability to investigate.
Is that what demand account means to bankers?
I don't know what their definition fully means other than what I read in Mr. Knight's letter to you, which I think is reasonably clear to me that funds would be available on demand for disbursement. There may
That's
be some.
Not what you mean.
No. The definition in 1.15 is more simple than that.
Why don't you just change the language so you don't use a word that's used in the banking business differently?
I think if I understand Mr. Knight's concern, it's their definition that creates the problem, not ours.
Well, I don't think we're going to be able to change the whole banking system.
I agree with that. There are a couple of potential solutions,
okay.
Chief. One would be to just simply recognize that we are using different definitions, and the bankers, I expect, would comply with federal definitions, and in terms of regulatory enforcement and the guidance to lawyers, our definition would likely suffice. Another alternative would be to just have some clarifying comment in the actual text of the rule that defines IOLTA, a demand, comma, as defined in this rule, comma, might be a potential solution. Another would be just to explain that there would be some concerns in the comment. It's possible at this point, because I don't fully understand what the concerns are, that we may need to do some redrafting, which we're perfectly willing to talk about and do, just to make sure that we've accommodated everyone's concerns.
Okay. Mr. Knight?
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I hope it's not going to be good evening, so good afternoon.
We all hope that, I think. But demand account banks, for example, money market deposit accounts are not demand accounts under federal law.
Demand accounts means you can take it out when, as soon as you want it.
Correct, like a checking account.
You don't have to wait 5 days or the first of the month or something like that.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
So can't we change the word here? What words would be good here to take care of the OLR needs?
Well, I'm not sure the word demand needs to be used throughout the IOLTA rule. And if their concern is an account subject to payment by a properly executed instrument, that's all they really need to say and call it an IOLTA account. The word demand just kind of confuses the banking industry.
Because it's used in a special way in the banking industry.
Right.
Okay.
Correct.
So I understand the lineup. It's this, that you want the word demand removed. I understand that WIS staff doesn't really care as long as OLR is satisfied, and OLR has some concerns. Is that your understanding of where we are on this issue?
It is my understanding. We want to make sure that the records are kept and available. And the difficulty is finding a word that isn't too restrictive.
Let's find one instead of demand. Okay?
That would be perfectly fine. We can do that. Mm-hmm.
All right. Maybe more than one word, Mr. Salim. Okay? Verified account. That's not quite right, but you can't have an accounted account. But there's some words that you have to express your statement about.
I understand, yes. We will find something appropriate.
Just stay away from a technical word in the banking industry.
I understand. We will.
Mm-hmm. All right. The other thing that I have is CM6D. This rule under remittance and reporting requires the lawyer to direct the IOLTA participating institution to respond to reasonable requests from WIS staff for information needed for purpose of certification as an IOLTA participating institution. Mr. Knight, do you have any comments on that? This allows this to the lawyer. You can tell the bank that if WISDF makes a reasonable request for information for purposes of certification as an IOLTA participating in institution, that's okay. Do you have any objections?
As long as we're instructed by the lawyer or the lawyer consents, we're fine with that.
Okay. Mr. Diedrich, do you have any problems? That's your rule, as I understand it.
It is, Your Honor, and I would offer to the court the fact that we feel that language is important to clarify the role of the lawyer. But I would acknowledge to the court that there is another provision that is critical to this point as well as to the point raised by the Bankers Association regarding the lawyer's involvement and the lawyer's choice.
Okay, what about, are you talking about CM4C? Lawyer or law firm must specify
right.
The account. Yeah, that's my next one. So let's just finish this up. Seems to me that you got the Bankers Association agreeing with your draft, Mr. Diedrich.
Yes.
You're ahead of the game at the moment. Right? So let's go to the next one, which I think is one that is troublesome. Lawyer or law firm, this is under CM4C also. Lawyer or law firm must specify account, and the bankers want to say at the direction of the lawyer or law firm. Let's just look at that, see what tab that was. Okay, for CM4C. CM4C is at page 9 of our document. An IOLTA participating institution may establish an IOLTA account as or convert an IOLTA account to any of the following. One, and we took out three, two, three, four, five. Now they want to add the words, what? And the alternate participant may establish at the direction of the lawyer or law firm. You don't want that.
That's correct.
Why not?
There are two reasons why we do not want that language added to the rule. The first reason is a very practical one. If, in fact, the suggestion is that this language, we believe, will destroy the ability of the Trust Account Foundation to work directly with the banks to make this rule make sense and operate effectively. If we're going to now have to have the banks deal with giving all the lawyer having to give all the direction and the lawyer making all the decisions, we're going to have to work through the lawyers, and that's going to affect our ability to effectively administer this plan. Now, I believe, although I'm not sure, but I believe that the concern here, as expressed by the Wisconsin Bankers Association, is but the relationship is between the bank and the customer being the lawyer. I do refer the court to page 8 of the materials, in which it is acknowledged, as it has been acknowledged in the past rule, that the WISDAF is the beneficial owner of the earned interest and dividends. And there is a basis for a relationship between WISDAF and the bank. In fact, that notion of being the beneficial owner of the earned interest or dividends pursuant to SCR Chapter 13 is an underpinning of how the WISDAF accounts and the IOLTA accounts are to be administered. So we believe that that language, plus the need to have an ability to do an administration of this rule with the banks, suggests and requires that the language stay as we have proposed. And the language as we have proposed is, in fact, language that we have received and worked on with representatives from the American Bar Association as well, who have been in assisting us as well as other states in implementing the rule.
Thank you, Mr. Diedrich. I think I understand that. All right. The other one is there is no provision for removal of financial institutions from the WISDAF list. Do we need it? There's no provision now. My question is, do we need one?
From the perspective of the Wisconsin Trust Account Foundation, we have no desire to remove anyone from the list.
Okay.
And we would propose that to give the banks assurances that there would be proper notices and communications, we would adopt an administrative policy as part of the implementation of this rule to give to the banks sufficient notice, communication and writing, those types of things. We think that would be a very appropriate way to address that.
Okay, thank you. Now, the effective date has ranged from January to July 1, assuming this gets done. I gather you don't object to July 1.
Do not.
Okay. But you, if I understood the materials, you wanted that the proceedings to start getting everybody in accordance with the rules, if passed, would start soon. So by the time July 1 came around, everybody would be theoretically certified or listed or whatever your terminology is.
That's correct. And if some banks are not able to...
We don't want to. Thank you.
I'm afraid I'm too loud. That's why I didn't do that. If some banks are not able to implement as of July 1 for whatever reason, what we would propose is that they implement when we are able to complete the implementation, but they would pay that rate retroactive to July 1 if they couldn't do their computer work and our computer work until September 1. They would pay it as of July 1.
Are there any other? One, Teresa, did we miss anything? Okay. Are there any other comments or questions
I do.
For either Mr. Smith, Mr. Saleen, Mr. Knight, or Mr. Dietrich?
And Mr. Dietrich and Mr. Knight, in the trial court, now is the time where I would make a record. We're not in the trial court, but I think it's fair that everyone be operating on equal footing because I intend on bringing it up at the open rules conference that I had the opportunity to visit with you both at the same time during the lunch break. I reemphasize to both of you my main concern in regard to this court setting a figure for the percent of interest to be paid on these. Each of you, in what I view as a very civil, very productive conversation, indicated that given a reasonable amount of time, that the two parties could get together and work out a number that would be mutually acceptable. And I am very much appreciative of your efforts. I don't know what my colleagues, I haven't had the opportunity before now to express that to my colleagues, but I view that as the route to go in regard to the setting of the number to at least grant the parties the opportunity to try to come up with such a number. And I wonder if there's anything, first of all, this is where I would ask if I was on the record in the trial court, if I have fully, fairly, and accurately set forward the terms of our conversation, and if there's anything either would like to add to it to make it more comprehensive or otherwise.
I would agree that that was what we discussed.
I believe that's an accurate statement. Thank you.
And do you both, was there anything that happened, has anything happened within the last hour to change either of your assessments that you think you could work out such an agreement?
No changes on my part. No.
How much time would be viewed as reasonable in your perspective?
Well, the only perspective that I have at this point is Thanksgiving and Christmas are in the way. That's the only perspective that I have right now. I don't know. I mean,
Thanksgiving?
Thanksgiving is in the way for me. I haven't quite made it to Christmas yet, but soon. I would talk with the people at the bankers' associations, and I'm sure we can make ourselves available
30 days.
Quickly. 30 days is reasonable.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Dietrich, under subprovision CM4 income requirements, in hear you. What's what?
4CM?
Yes, CM4. Sub A, income requirements, there's a provision that designates IOLTA accounts to be held in a way that WISTAF is the beneficial owner of any earned interest. Does that create any kind of a substantive right in WISTAF if we set this up so that they have any substantive rights as a result of this?
I would have to say that it creates a substantive right, which is the foundation for the U.S. Supreme Court rulings, which allow the interest income to flow to IOLTA to the Trust Account Foundation for distribution. That language actually is in the current rule. And I do believe it creates the substantive right that is necessary for satisfying the constitutional requirements.
The import of the justice's question, I think, is that this is coming in under 751, I think it's 12, as a rule of procedure that should not affect substantive rights. Isn't that the import of your question?
Yes, right. And to me, it appears to be a substantive provision. I don't know if it's necessary to the rule or not necessary to the rule, but it did appear to me to be a substantive provision.
This has been in the rule since it was adopted.
Yes, it has.
It may have been, but it makes it no less substantive. It's in a different location,
right.
I think, currently. That's
right. And I believe that those issues were addressed at the time of the initial adoption of the rule.
Thank you. But you see, there was no money before that. Before the initial rule, there was no interest. So it wasn't like you were taking a substantive right away. And under the, as I understand the U.S. Supreme Court, but as I said this morning, I've reread that opinion. It's not taking a property right.
That's my understanding of the ruling of the court.
So That's why it's hard to identify it as a substantive right for terms of our rulemaking, but that does not mean that a majority of the court will not do so. It's just that those are the two possible out of many arguments. Okay.
Thank you.
Mr. Diedrich, I want to thank you on behalf of the court for all the work you've done, not only on this, but on numerous other rules hearing that have come before the court in the last several years. So
thank you.
A special thanks. And you are a glutton for punishment here, not only in helping write and draft them, then taking our questions and comments, and then three, having to listen to our discussion and not being able to participate, as you probably think we are making numerous errors. And you may be right about some, not all, or not numerous. So I do want to express those thanks on behalf of the court.
Thank you very much.
And I want to thank Mr. Smith for coming in and his expertise. Mr. Saleem has carefully reviewed everything as he does, and participating so closely with Mr. Diedrich and with staff in making sure that these rules will fit both the regulatory scheme as well as the banking scheme. And Mr. Knight, I want to thank you on behalf of the court for ably representing the Wisconsin Bankers Association and the community bankers in participating in an unusual way of conducting this proceeding, but I hope it worked out well. Thank you. That closes the hearing on 0803 in the matter of amendment of SCR 20:1.15, safekeeping property, trust accounts, and fiduciary accounts. We're now going to move into an area that I was going to say I do hope we understand better. 0807 in the matter of the amendment of Supreme Court Rule SCR 4005 relating to admitting lawyers upon proof of practice elsewhere. I've got as a presenter James Christian, Vice Chair, Board of Bar Examiners. The other appearances are John Kasabuki, Michael McCarty, Stephen Levine, and Dean Diedrich. Thank you, Dean, again. Mr. Diedrich, I should say.
Excuse me, Chief. Is someone getting just...
I thought the marshal was, but...
She is.
She's on her way. So I will proceed. Okay. James Houston, presenter. What I was going to say is the court has scheduled today not only these two matters, and I will tell you that the first one took longer than I had expected and planned for, and so I'm hoping that you will pleasantly surprise us by having this one take a shorter time.
I hope
that for a broad hint.
I shall try to be very brief.
All right. And you've been very patient sitting here, but I'm sure you learned a lot about trust accounts and banking.
My excitement knows no bounds, Your Honor.
I thought that's apparent. I can't top that, no, so you may as well proceed.
There are two broad items in this petition. One is a major policy issue. It is very simple to explain and takes no time at all. The other is more complicated, less substantial. These other things are maybe tweakings that may help us to administer this rule more effectively. And if you decide against us on the major matter, we would still like you to think about these minor matters and perhaps go along with us on those. The major matter is to strike from the present rule sections 1C and 1M and 6. 6 you strike because it is only a reference back to 1C and 1M. And we ask you to strike 1C and 1M because this will totally eliminate
the concept of reciprocity in the admission on motion by virtue of a lawyer's practice elsewhere. My friend, former bar president, Mr. Levine, has submitted a written document that gives you several reasons why he thinks you should do this. I think they're fine reasons, but we really have only one reason, and that is that we think that admitting or making more qualified lawyers in the United States eligible for admission in Wisconsin is better for the consumers of legal services in Wisconsin. If there are more good lawyers here, there is more choice for the people who need legal services, and so we would ask you to eliminate reciprocity such that lawyers from California and Florida and New York will now be eligible for admission here, and as they are not now because their states do not admit Wisconsin lawyers on motion.
All right, what do you substitute for reciprocity, Mr. Houston?
I don't substitute anything for it. Sure.
Well, you say 3 out of 5 years.
Oh, the length of time that is involved, the present Wisconsin rule says 3 years out of the past 5. We are suggesting that you change that to 5 out of 7.
Right.
As a factual matter, the present rule has almost no effect in Wisconsin because of reciprocity. Under the reciprocity rules, if another state from which this lawyer is applying for admission has a rule that says in order for a Wisconsin lawyer to be admitted here in state X, he must stand in a cemetery at midnight and draw the blood of a frog and so forth, then the lawyer from that state must also go through that process in order to be admitted in Wisconsin. Of the 21 or 22 states which have reciprocity with Wisconsin, 17 of them require at least 5 years of experience. So almost everyone who has ever been admitted on motion in Wisconsin under these rules has had to have 5 years of experience in order to qualify. We think that's a fair number. Only 2 states allow admission after 3 years, 2 states allow admission after 4 years of experience, and all the rest require 5 years of experience. Looking back on my own experience, I think I was a better lawyer after 5 years than I was after 3. And anyway, that's...
10. Maybe you're a better lawyer after 10.
I hope so. But perhaps 10 is too many. We think 5 out of 7 is a reasonable compromise.
My understanding is we haven't had any problems in the years, the many years that we've had 3 out of 5. So why change it? I mean, I understand your reasons for wanting to change the reciprocity part of the statute, but why bother changing it from 3 out of 5, the last 5, I think it says, to 5 out of 7. If we have any problems, what, you know?
Hardly anyone has been admitted with only 3 years of experience.
Yeah, but we're talking about reciprocity rules, and you're telling us to get rid of them. So, okay, I'm agreeing with you. They're gone. Well, if I say that, why do I need to change the second piece of the puzzle when there have been no problems with our current rule?
Your Honor, we are much more interested in getting rid of reciprocity general than in what number of years. This was not a strong point with the board.
Well, I understand that. I'm just trying to figure out why you did it. I mean, if you haven't had any problems, why would you decide to change a part of the rule that wasn't problematic?
We did it as in the fashion of tendering a compromise to what we thought might be opposition to this rule itself.
I see. Okay, fine. I understand that. Thank you.
If there are no other questions on the major part of this change that we're supposed to propose.
What about a lawyer may satisfy this requirement by proof of practice in more than a single jurisdiction under more than one provision of this rule? Do you have any objection to that?
We have no objection to that, Your Honor.
Okay.
But we don't think that language is necessary. We have always enforced applied the rule in that way.
You know, I never read it that way. I'm just telling you, that came as a surprise. I always thought you had to do it in one jurisdiction and you couldn't piece it together. So, I know, that's just my impression. I agree it wasn't in the rule, but that's what I always thought. So you don't object to stating it because that's your practice. Okay. All right. Now we get to the second event. I'm sorry. Justice Prosser.
Let's see. 1MB that you want to eliminate. Could you explain that, please?
Why we make that change to actively and substantially? Yes.
No. The one that references SCR 4003. One M, paragraph B.
Are you in 40.05? Yeah. All right.
This is the rule that requires us to apply another state's rules to people who want to apply in Wisconsin, and we would simply strike it. I guess I don't understand your question.
What's the difference between A and B?
Oh. I'm not sure that there is any practical difference. The one states that if the other state doesn't admit on motion, we won't either. The other one ties it down to the diploma privilege. Whether there are other states which will generally apply, generally admit Wisconsin lawyers, or would admit Wisconsin lawyers if they had not been admitted in Wisconsin under the diploma privilege. We're saying the old rule said they can't be admitted here.
Question I want to get to. Are there states who might admit a Wisconsin attorney who has practiced, say, for 5 years, but would not admit that Wisconsin attorney because that attorney didn't take a bar examination?
I don't know. Does Mr. Kosobuki mind?
If you are asking if there are jurisdictions that would not admit an attorney who is a diploma privilege graduate in Wisconsin, even though they may have completed the time requirements in the state, I believe there are a couple of states that will not accept a diploma privilege graduate under any circumstances, no matter how much time they have served in another state, in Wisconsin, for example.
I think New Hampshire is one of those. New Hampshire or Vermont, because we got a letter from one of our long-time lawyers who moved to one of the New England states, and they would not do that even under special petition, et cetera. So there are those states. If I'm wrong about which one, but there are. You even have states, and you mentioned California, who will not let any lawyer in without a bar exam. And I think you have the retirement states, Arizona and Florida, similar, at least the last time I looked, were like that. This rule would just say, you practice 3 to 5, right?
5 to 7.
I'm sorry, you're saying 5 to 7. Then you can be admitted. What about any moral and character fitness, or it's just that you've been in practice and you haven't gotten clipped in the other jurisdiction?
This rule only speaks to the fact that you don't have to take a bar exam. Okay. You still must pass our character and fitness investigation.
Good.
That would not change.
And your concept of putting in actively and substantially engaged in the practice of law. And then you say, in the United States, you took out the word courts of. Well, if you say that somebody practiced in the United States, It would seem to me that included any state or territory or D.C. I mean, the point of taking out it, putting in courts, meant you talked about federal courts versus state courts. I mean, I think I practice in the United States, practicing in Wisconsin, but I don't practice in the courts of the United States.
We made that change as a non-substantial change, simply because we found that there seemed to be some confusion as to whether one had to be a litigator in order to qualify under this rule.
I understand that. That's why I actively and substantially raised those questions, but we've never been able to figure out a better way of saying that. It just, and I have tried over the years and have watched people who say they're actively and substantially engaged in the practice, and the question is that practice? Is it active? Is it substantial? Is half time good enough? That kind of thing. That's still a problem here.
But you did point out something that I had not seen, and you're absolutely right. If we say United States, why do we have to add another?
Don't.
Yeah, so.
But because what you're getting at is maybe you could say in the jurisdiction of the United States or another state. I don't know, but otherwise it's a little odd. But
yes.
I could live with it.
I would like to say just a word about the change from primarily to actively and substantially. Under this rule that said one had to be primarily practicing law, we got the adding machines out. And if someone worked only 40% of the time, she wasn't working primarily. And so that time wouldn't count. And so we would get instances of, and this often generally happened with women who would be on maternity leave, and we'd be counting how many hours of 40 she worked when she was off. And we don't think that's necessary. We think it is better to have something that doesn't suggest counting, but looks at whether one is actively and substantially practicing law. Both of those, though, primarily on the one hand or actively and substantially on the other, they are questions of fact. They are something for the board to investigate and make a decision about. And so for reasons that I will point out in a minute, we don't want this phrase actively and substantially dropped into any other paragraph of this rule. We don't want to create a presumption that if you have the title corporate counsel or something of the sort, that you are therefore actively and substantially practicing law. You're actively and substantially practicing law as corporate counsel only if, as corporate counsel, you're doing that. But if I have the title general counsel at my brother-in-law's used car lot, and I spend 90% of my time selling cars, I am not actively and substantially practicing law.
What does actively mean? If I'm engaged, I assume it's the same thing as if I'm engaged in the active practice of law, I assume you're using it in the same way, actively engaged, active practice of law. What does that mean?
I have not thought of an answer to that, Justice.
I don't either, and that's why I asked the question. There's a connotation in my mind that someone who's actively engaged in law brings up a number of things. But one primary thing is that they are in it quite a bit. In other words, I'm not sure what substantially adds. I'm engaged in the active private practice of law. I would think that's a person who is doing it a lot. I don't think, to me, actively means a person who is alive and well, but and healthy, but only will do 3 hours to 5 hours a month. So I just don't know what actively means. And I don't know what it means vis-a-vis substantially, because there's a substantial component
to active in my mind. Any thoughts? Since we're using these words and since you're proposing them, it just seems to me that we should have a common understanding of what they mean.
I think they mean about what you were saying, that taken at least together, and you may be right that we could use either one of them without adding the other. They mean that, I mean, what we intend to mean here is that the person is practicing law. And practicing law, as you say, a lot. Not necessarily 51% of the time. 40% is probably enough. But really practicing law.
If this rule that you just articulated applied to me, I'm not sure I would be sitting on this court.
Because you were in the legislature?
Sure,
well, I don't think it would apply if it said, it would also not apply if it said primarily.
But I don't think that's the issue, whether it's active and substantially. A thing is engaged in the practice of law. It goes back to the definition of what's the practice of law. Is that your point, Justice Prosser?
Well, I'm simply following up on Justice Bradley's questions here. It seems to me that I'm not sure exactly what this means, but I don't think it's very helpful to me. The question I really wanted to ask you goes back to 1MB. Mr. Casabucky has explained that there are some states that will not admit people who became members of the bar because of the diploma privilege. They are forced to take a bar examination. So that, Mr. Houston, you would be able to gain admission in those states. And Mr. Levine would be able to gain admission in those states. And the Chief Justice and Justice Crooks and Justice Gableman would be able to obtain admission in those states. But the other members of this court would simply be excluded. Now, why is it good policy that we have nothing to say about that? Because we'll admit anybody here.
The lawyer in one of those states, Hampshire, if it is, has no ability, no real ability, to make New Hampshire change its rule. So if he or she is a qualified lawyer and wants to come to Wisconsin, we think it is good policy not to throw up any barriers against that person's admission here, because that additional capable, qualified, experienced lawyer from New Hampshire is one more lawyer who can be used by the consumers of legal services in Wisconsin.
Frankly, this, I think that argument is somewhat idiotic. And I say that with respect, but it is exactly the same argument that we heard in terms of dog tracks. Let them all come in. Not just one or two. Just unlimited dog tracks. And they're all out of business. It was chaotic. I mean, this is an institution that regulates the bar and ought to be concerned a little bit about the health of this profession. And I don't see that in this proposal. I don't see any sense at all that you care about that in this proposal.
I don't think that the lawyers in New Hampshire or New York or California are going to flood Wisconsin such that lawyers in Wisconsin find themselves without enough clients to keep their businesses going. The market works both ways. We think that there will be no more lawyers in Wisconsin than are necessary. Why then don't we want to accept lawyers from California or New York just because California and New York will not admit our lawyers?
Well, it seems to me that there are lawyers in other states who can have specialties. And they can come into this state and they can cherry pick, and they'll have a certain allure because they're specialists from Chicago or New York or something like that. And you enable them to compete unfairly because the people with specialties in our bar will not be able to go to an awful lot of other states. It strikes me as extremely unfair. People who live on the border, our attorneys who live on the border, might very well have simply be at a disadvantage with people who live on the other side of the border. I don't get any sense of that in this rule. And I think, frankly, the provision in subsection 1MB is just telling people who have the diploma privilege, you are not equal. And we're not going to protect you because you're not equal. You're not equal to people who graduated from the University of Chicago and took a bar exam.
I guess it's a policy question, Your Honor. If we are going to protect the lawyers who are admitted in Wisconsin as a result of the diploma privilege, why don't we want to protect the lawyers who are admitted in Wisconsin by virtue of taking a bar exam? That's what the present rules do. They say if New Hampshire will not admit, if New York, Florida, California will not admit any Wisconsin lawyer, then we will not admit lawyers from those states. I don't make a distinction between Wisconsin lawyers who are admitted under the diploma privilege and those who are admitted by virtue of the bar exam or by motion.
If I understand this proposal, the theory of it is that bars should not be put up for lawyers to cross state boundaries except for competency. In that, the theory is that if a lawyer has practiced 5 out of 7 years in another state and has the moral character fitness, that the citizens or the people of the state should have the right to hire him or her. That's the theory.
Should have the ability to hire.
Okay. So it's not the basis upon which the old law still is the law, might still be the law after today. Basis of the reciprocity was that if we took a tough stand against members of the bar of other states and said, you can't come in here without taking the bar, we would put pressure on the other states to open their doors. And that after 1, 2, 8, 10, 20, 100 years, the pressure we put on these other states would make the lawyers of the other states and the bench of the other states open up the doors, and we would have a full United States where the lawyers did not have to do special things when they crossed the boundaries. That was the theory. How old is this law? Do you know?
I do not know.
Well, it's a good, I'd say, 10 years, maybe longer. And the last time I checked, no state had changed its rules in order to have their lawyers come into Wisconsin. That was the theory of this. Everybody, especially the boundary states, would change because of this pressure. Didn't work. So the question is, what theory do you want to use? Do you want to use we are going to protect our lawyers, whether it's a bar exam lawyer or a graduate of a law school lawyer? Doesn't matter. Or is the theory a consumer theory of giving the consumers as many lawyers as they want and let them choose and let the market determine it? The market and OLR. The market and OLR. So that's the theory here. And when we adopted these rules on reciprocity, the theory of the court was the one I told you, that we would force change indirectly, because other lawyers who wanted to come in and couldn't get in easily would change their laws. So you got reciprocity. Now you've changed, VB has changed this. So, have I accurately stated it?
Yes, you have, Your Honor.
Even with the histrionics? But especially because...
Well, I can...
Just wanted to be sure.
Mr. Houston, I understand the rationale behind the rules change, and I'd like to talk about the increase from 3 out of 5 to 5 out of 7. You've indicated that the board didn't feel too strongly about it. I think that's what you said. And so that being said, and I understand the context in which it's coming, what was the purpose of raising the 5 years? You made a reference, you thought you were a better lawyer after 5 than you were out of 3. Was that pretty much sum it up, an increase in the quality?
No, the impetus to make that change was that we thought this proposal would meet with opposition from the state bar.
Oh.
And as it turned out, it did not. The state bar supports this rule change. But we thought, let's change this from 3 to 5 to 5 out of 7 as a palliative, as something that may make it easier for the state bar to come along with us.
Okay.
That's really what was behind the proposing this change.
All right, fair enough. Thank you.
Well, that leaves the next question. Did you get any... Did the court, I don't think so, did they get any comments from our boundary communities saying, keep the gates closed?
I am unaware of anybody who has submitted something to the court in opposition to this change.
And the state bar did not oppose this?
The state bar has sent a letter saying we support the rule.
Okay. All right. I thought that was the easier one. So in light of that, let's move on to the other provision.
Well, we have talked about a number of them. I think for reasons that I'll get to in a minute, we should strike the word elsewhere in the title of this section, because a lawyer who is a corporate counsel in Wisconsin can... The Moskoff situation qualifies under the rule as we have proposed it.
Okay.
And the way we get there, I would call your attention to paragraph 2, which reads, and I'm going to leave out a lot of words as I read this. The present rule reads, legal service as corporate counsel, if conducted in the state in which the person is admitted, is deemed to be practicing law. We change that requirement that the practice be in the state where the lawyer was admitted to read, legal service as corporate counsel, if conducted in compliance with the rules of some other United States jurisdiction where the person is admitted to the practice of law. The point of that, the reason we proposed that change, and we did this before you changed the rule that created the registered, that created a registration system for in-house counsel. We had a lawyer apply who was admitted in Minnesota, but lived and practiced law, not as corporate counsel, in Wisconsin. He was in a financial services firm. His practice was entirely involving federal tax law. He practiced in the United States tax courts, but because he was not practicing in the state in which he was admitted, namely Minnesota, initially his application was rejected. We then held a hearing, met with him, and waived that requirement and admitted him. That's the Moskoff situation. We didn't like it, and so we made this change so that if you make this change in the rule, a lawyer admitted in Minnesota, practicing law as corporate counsel or in any other way in Wisconsin that doesn't require her to already be admitted in Wisconsin, that person's experience will be counted as meeting the 3 years or 5 years or whatever it is. We ask you to make that change.
Well, even accepting all of that, why don't you say, instead of maybe deemed to be, is? Either it is or it isn't. And it's is.
That's fine. Maybe deemed is the present language.
The other thing is, where does it say in compliance with the rules of the United States, or maybe it's not important there?
I don't think it is, because lawyers are not admitted to the bar of the United States alone, I think.
It says, lawfully before the courts or administrative agency of the United States or another state or territory, if conducted in compliance with the rules of a state or territory, or of the District of Columbus. So suppose you have a social security lawyer in Wisconsin. Maybe he's an administrative judge. Is that going to be good enough?
Yes, it is.
All right. So he's an administrative judge in Milwaukee for Social Security. So he's before administrative agency of the United States and is conducted in compliance with the rules of the state. Is that good enough in Wisconsin?
He is able to be an administrative law judge in Wisconsin because he has been admitted to the bar in some other state and is practicing in compliance with the rules of that other state.
Okay.
We would ask you, the Corporate Counsel Association has asked that the words active and substantial be added in this paragraph 2 before the word practice of law. We ask you not to do that. And the reason is that whether or not one is actively and substantially practicing law is a question of fact. We don't want to create a presumption of law that merely because one is corporate counsel, one is actively and substantially practicing law here. We want to ask whether the person is actively practicing law.
Well, where do you get the right to ask that if you take out the words active and substantial?
From paragraph 1B.
All right.
The court has ordered us to count corporation counsel's time in Wisconsin if they have registered under the new scheme for registering corporate counsel. As I have pointed out to you, a corporate counsel in Wisconsin, general counsel in Wisconsin, who has been here for 5 years, could come in tomorrow and ask to be admitted, and if you make the changes that we have asked you to make, we would count those 5 years in the past. But what about a general counsel who wants to count experience in 2009 and 10 and 11, but has not registered under your rule? That isn't covered by the proposal that we have here. We don't think that person's experience as corporate counsel in Wisconsin, but not registered, should count, and we will make that change in our appendix if necessary, or we would invite you to add a paragraph to your order telling us to do it that way.
This is not retroactive. Is that what the bracket is? Bracket proposed that service conducted prior to filing registration should be considered. So that would make it retroactive. So if 3 years ago you were counsel, corporate counsel, it would count.
That paragraph, that entire paragraph has been proposed not by us, but from the Association of Corporate Counsel. We do not think that paragraph is necessary. We don't oppose it, but we think the rule without that paragraph...
I'm sorry, what paragraph? You mean the parenthetical, all such service conducted prior to filing the registration?
The whole paragraph 2M
yes.
is not part of our petition.
All right.
That paragraph has been proposed by the ACC. We don't think it's necessary. As I have explained to you, we think that the language that we have, the changes that we proposed in paragraph 2, take care of this retroactivity
Got it.
Issue.
I understand that.
I have no other points to offer, unless the justices have questions of me.
Any comments? All right, thank you, Mr. Houston.
You're welcome.
You may appear at the end if you think it's necessary. Mr. Casabucci?
I will be very brief as my...
That's what they all say.
As my co-counsel, my enthusiasm also has no bounds. In considering your previous hearing on the IOLTA petitions, if we get more attorneys coming in under the proposed rule, there would obviously be more trust accounts and then more funds in the IOLTA accounts that may be able to be accounted for. I just want to clarify one position or one point on the 3 of 5 versus 5 of 7. Although the base rule does say 3 of 5 years, you have to revert to what the rules of the other jurisdictions were. So of the 21 jurisdictions that we currently have reciprocity with, only 2 have 3 of 5. So essentially, we have been operating under the 5 of 7 rule.
Yeah, and Mr. Houston made note of that. Do you have any strong objection to the 3 out of 5 continuing?
No, I don't. No, sir. And I hope that was brief enough.
Does anyone want to ask him any questions? Thank you, Mr. Casabucci.
Well done.
Mr. McCarty, Counsel, Wisconsin Association of Corporation Counsel. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Chief Justice. And I'm pleased to be here again. I want to focus my comments only on the issue relating to in-house counsel. And the only reason we're here at all is the court will recall that your order on petition 0606, where you changed the rules relating to in-house counsel and added this registration requirement for corporate counsel, that came out July 30th, I believe. The Board of Bar Examiners' proposed language had been already submitted to the court before that. So in reviewing the proposal by BBE, we just felt that it didn't expressly address the new registration requirement. I want to make it clear, in general, we support the BBE's proposal. We support the change in reciprocity. We don't have any strong objection to changing it from 3 to 5 to 5 to 7. So we were only trying to get more express language around how we're going to treat this registration requirement. And I did want to make clear that we were expressly trying to get language in there that would make it retroactive. This would address a situation where a lawyer has been practicing in Wisconsin in good faith reliance on the Moskoff decision, which said the time may not count for admission, but you can continue to practice in-house in Wisconsin without violating the rule against unauthorized practice of law. So if we've had lawyers now practicing here for any number of years and they register in accordance with the new registration requirement, we just feel substantively there's no reason not to treat that as active and substantial practice and give them credit for it. And it's another incentive to get them into the state bar and make them full dues-paying members. So we think that would probably be a good policy rule to adopt. So we put language in here essentially adding an express paragraph that deals with the court's registration requirement under SCR 10.0304F and expressly saying that it would count retroactively provided that they made a timely application or registration. And I think that addresses the point that Mr. Houston raised, that absent some express language like that, it's not clear how you would treat somebody who just chooses not to register. If they come along later and seek admission on motion, it should be expressly in the rule that that time won't count because they had an opportunity to register and they didn't take it. So it would work both ways. It makes it clear that it would count retroactively if they do register, and it wouldn't count prospectively if they don't.
Do we need both 2 or 2M or just 2M?
I believe it's 2M in the version that you were given. I guess they renumbered it. In the one that was attached to my letter, I had actually added this as new Section 3, but when the Legislative Reference Bureau rewrote it, it was 2M.
Yours, do you need 2N, 3, or just 3? You prefer
just 3.
Okay. Thank you. Any other comments?
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McCarty. You've waited a long time. Thanks. Mr. Levine, you too have waited a long time. It works.
Thank you. If it pleases the court, my name is Steve Levine. I'm a lawyer from Madison. I'm also a member of the State Bar Board of Bar Examiners Review Committee, and I've been authorized by that committee to state that the committee supports the first two changes that the Board of Bar Examiners is proposing here, but opposes the change from 3 of 5 years to 5 of 7 years. The first thing I'd like to say is that in the past 30 years, I've been told by a number of circuit court judges that I was preaching to the choir and to be quiet. So I would be glad to forego any argument at all if the court would tell me that I don't have to make it in favor of retaining the 3-year period.
I won't tell you that because
bargain's here.
That's right. It crosses my mind that it may not benefit consumers to lower the standards of qualification for lawyers. In essence, we've had 5 to 7 years in most states that have reciprocity with us, 17 out of 21 or 22. So it seems to me, de facto, because of the provision that we'll do unto them what they do unto us, that it has been, in most instances, a requirement of 5 to 7 years. Why does lowering that benefit either lawyers or consumers?
Well, let me give a little bit of history about that that might answer your question. Up until 30 years ago, the period for reciprocity admission in Wisconsin was 5 of 7 years. At that time, it was 1977 or 78. The State Bar Young Lawyers Division formed a committee, and after a 2-year study and preparing of a report that was submitted to the Supreme Court, asked the court to make a number of changes in bar admission requirements. One of the changes was to lower that period from 5 of 7 years to 3 of 5. So the 3 of 5 year period that's there right now is not something that's been there for the last 150 years and is just a matter of inertia. It's been examined by the court and specifically changed from 5 of 7 to 3 of 5 years. Originally, the additional reciprocity provision that said that if another state has a higher period, you apply that period, was not a part of that rule. What happened was when the Young Lawyers Division came in with its report and its request to the court, the State Bar didn't participate in that at all. But a few years later, the state bar came back and convinced the court that that rule was too liberal and added that reciprocity provision that if another state has a higher period, then Wisconsin should apply that higher period. So a few years, I'm not sure how many it was, but for a few years, that three-year period was there without the additional provision. Additionally, the court should know that the state of Michigan is a three-year reciprocity provision state. In the Great Lakes area of the four contiguous states, Michigan, Wisconsin, Illinois, and Minnesota, right now, two have five-year periods, Illinois and Minnesota, and two have three-year periods, Wisconsin and Michigan. I would not be surprised at all that there would be the unintended consequence if Wisconsin raised the period to 5 years, that Michigan authorities looked at the situation and said, why should we be the only state that has a three-year period? We'll raise ours to 5 years, too. In which case, northern Wisconsin lawyers in Rhineland or in Marinette, in Hurley, in whatever community in northern Wisconsin, who may value that cross-border business that they can get from the three-year reciprocity period in Michigan, are going to be directly affected by this rule. So I think the court should also be aware that changing the rule to 5 years may affect Wisconsin lawyers as much as it affects lawyers from other states coming into Wisconsin. I also want to point out that whatever requirement there is for other lawyers coming into Wisconsin, under the three-year period right now, a lawyer who's coming in on proof of practice elsewhere has within just a few years taken a bar exam in the state that they were originally admitted in. And that bar exam included the same multi-state bar exam that was given in the year that they took it in Wisconsin. It seems to me, number one, that there's no need to retest them on the multi-state bar exam, which makes up more or less half of the bar exam in Wisconsin, in such a short period of time after they've already tested. When a person takes the Wisconsin bar exam and they pass the local portion and the multi-state portion, we don't ask them 4 years, 4.5 years later, pass the same exam again, which is in effect what you're doing when you make other people who are coming into Wisconsin take the bar exam a second time that they've already taken. I am glad, I'm relieved, and I want to thank Mr. Houston. First of all, I want to congratulate Mr. Houston, Judge Constantine, and Mr. Morrison, who's the vice chair of the BBE, for their farsightedness in bringing these rule changes to the court. But I especially want to thank Mr. Houston because I've lost a lot of sleep the past few nights trying to decide whether I should inform the court that the only reason that the Board of Bar Examiners is proposing this change from 3 years to 5 years is as a political compromise. So I'm glad that he said that. The reason that it was proposed is, like he said, the board was afraid that there would be substantial resistance to the first two changes that the board was proposing. And so the board wanted to be able to come back and to say to any critics, no, we aren't opening the door totally by proposing these first two amendments. We're actually toughening by changing it from 3 of 5 years to 5 of 7. The criticism and the opposition that the board feared never materialized. The Board of Governors supports the two changes. The Board of Bar Examiners Review Committee supports these changes. And I would hope that the court doesn't change it to 5 years because nothing has happened in the past 30 years since this three-year period has been in effect that's been any problem whatsoever in admitting new people from other states. If there are any other questions, I'd be glad to answer.
You're not talking about the general counsel, house counsel?
No.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions? Thank you, Mr. Levine.
Thank you.
All right. Let's see now. We've got Mr. Diedrich.
With the indulgence of the court, my name is Dean Diedrich, and I'm only appearing on my own behalf, not as a representative of anyone. And I hope you will do that.
That
Look at it that
you
way.
For everything. All right.
I was involved with the registration requirement, as I think most of the court knows. And when I came today, I didn't know that there was going to be a general agreement regarding this issue of the retroactivity of the registration requirement. Personally, I have struggled with that because trying to go through a lot of steps to get the registration requirement, at first I didn't like the idea that now somebody who's practiced for perhaps 10 years without the registration could now kind of walk in through this process. But, you know, I gotten older and I can live with things, and I must confess that this is, we do need to give recognition to people who have practiced for years in Wisconsin, albeit under some colored circumstances, not sure what, whether they were properly practicing or not. And so I do support the changes. As to the exact language, I'm glad to leave that to other drafters and not have to be responsible for that, although I tried to mediate between the two gentlemen earlier. But I do support that we would then allow someone who was not registered, but when they do become registered, can count their prior years of service. Thank you very much.
That would be under 2M with that bracket.
That's correct.
Statement. Okay. Thank
That's
you,
correct.
Mr. Dietrich. We appreciate
Mr.
you
Dietrich.
Saying. I'm sorry. Justice Prosser.
Mr. Casabucci indicated that the more people who come in out of state, more people who are admitted, the more trust accounts that would open up. If someone is an attorney from another state and they're admitted to practice in Wisconsin, must their trust account be in Wisconsin?
If they are engaged in the practice of law in Wisconsin, they must have a trust account in the state of Wisconsin. That's identified under the location rules in the trust account rule. The only area where we have some lack of clarity is a lawyer who's licensed in two states and practices in both states. That is an area I know that there's not complete clarity on, both in under the rule and in practice. But if somebody who is admitted through this process would open an office and engage in the practice in Wisconsin, they would be fully a bar member. They would have to make the certifications under the trust account certifications in the bar registration, and they would have to have their trust account following the trust account rules in Wisconsin.
This is sort of a yes or no question.
Okay.
I guess I didn't. Let's say we have a Minnesota attorney or an Iowa attorney or an Illinois attorney who is admitted in Illinois and admitted in Wisconsin, but doesn't have an office in Wisconsin. They just come over once in a while.
I see.
They might have clients who come to them, and they're able to go into Wisconsin courts. They're able to advise on Wisconsin law. Do they have to open a Wisconsin trust account?
They have no Wisconsin trust funds. That's the other part of your question.
Right. Yeah. Right. I know this is an issue that I have had questions about and spoken on, and I also know I've spoken with Mr. Saleen over the years about this question, and I believe that the current practice, and I'm hustling to find if there's any reference to it in the rule, I believe the current practice is they do not open a separate Wisconsin trust account, Wisconsin-based trust account. If their practice is in Illinois, Harvard, Illinois, but they come over and handle cases in Wisconsin. I don't think that's the practice. There are some particular rules about location, and the location rule says the trust account shall be maintained in a financial institution that is authorized by federal or state law to do business in Wisconsin, that is located in Wisconsin or has a branch office located in Wisconsin. So there are, if they have a branch office in Wisconsin, but they have their main office in Harvard, Illinois, and they maintain their trust account in Harvard, Illinois, I think that might be in compliance with the rule. It is a gray area, I acknowledge.
So in those circumstances, the interest on the trust account would go to another state? So
would go to Illinois state, yes. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Dietrich. Is there anyone present who feels compelled to testify on 0807 in the matter of the amendment of the Supreme Court Rule 4005 relating to admitting lawyers upon proof of practice elsewhere? Hearing none, the hearing on 0807 is concluded, and we will be out shortly to sit in open administrative conference to discuss and I hope decide 0803, 0807. I'm sure we'll never get to a discussion of the draft order 0815 and 0818. I'm hoping we can conclude 0501 quickly, and I'll do that first, as a matter of fact. So the open administrative rules hearings on November 18th are now closed. The court will reconvene in conference.